And good morning, the West Coast. Good afternoon, the East Coast. And good evening, Israel and in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, of course. This is Orly Benny Davis, and this is The Impossible Truth. Today is February 27, 2017, and we're so happy to, talk to you a day after the Oscars. And after what happened last night, I'm sure that you all are planning to see the movie that will be created on that event that took place last night. What I can say to you is Hollywood is still rocking, kept us on our toes, and the end with a bang, as we can say. Anyway, I'm so happy that La La Land was a champion because I saw the movie. I was thinking that the champion was the actress was incredible, very talented, and she did deserve the Oscar. And I don't know about all the other people, but for that matter, this is my gift to you. I hope that you'll enjoy my show now. Let's listen. We have Nigel Farage, the Englishman that keep us always, interested in the English politics because he's getting involved with American, everyday's life. He understand what the American life is supposed to look like, and maybe he has something to say about it. And as far as the English goes, they've been out of the European Union now for a few months, not officially. They just triggering Article 50 now, and their input to the universal order is very important. So let's listen to what Nigel Farage has to say.
Thank you. And I'm very honored to be here today. I'm delighted and thrilled that CPAC invited me, a foreigner, in your country. But it's a funny thing. Since November the 8th, since the election of Donald J. Trump, every time I come to America, I'm feeling a little bit more American, I have to tell you. When, in years to come, the generations that follow us study the history of this period, there is one year that will stand out. There is one year that every school child will know. And that year is the year of 2016. Because in 2016, we witnessed the beginning of a global political revolution, and it's one that is not going to stop. It's one that is going to roll out across the rest of the free world. I had been fighting against Britain's membership of the European Union for 25 years. 25 years. And if you've endured abuse, if you've been called deplorable, you've only had a few months of being abused. I've had 20 years of it. But you know what? None of it mattered. I always believed that we should govern our own country. I always believed we should be free to reach out and make our own deals with our real friends in the world. And it's funny. Our real friends in the world speak English, have common law, and stand by us in times of crisis. So I battled away for all those years. I thought I might become the patron saint of lost causes. And then the referendum came along, and we were told by vast sections of the media that we couldn't do it. We were told by many of the pollsters we couldn't do it. We were told by many of the commentators. Any of this ring familiar with you guys? We were told by the commentators that we couldn't do it. And they lined up all the big businesses, all the big banks, all the big politics, not just from Britain, but from across the world. Do you know, we even had a visit from the 44th President of the United States. of America. I will, to my dying day, be grateful that President Obama came to my country, intervened in the referendum, and told the United Kingdom's people, told America's greatest friend and ally in the world, and told us that if we voted to get our independence, we would go to the back of the line. And the British people were so disgusted by Obama treating us like this that it put us up 2% in the polls. So I should always be grateful to Obama. So the great day came, 23rd of June, 2016, and by 3 o'clock in the morning, it was clear that after a period of just after four decades in which our politically corrupt rulers had given away our independence, our democracy, our sovereignty, the ability to make our own laws, the ability to choose our own friends, the ability to make the right trade deals with the right countries. Oh, and they'd also given away control of our borders. And by 3 o'clock in the morning of June the 24th, it was clear the nightmare had come to an end. We had voted to get our country back. And I can't tell you how thrilled and pleased that I'd felt. It seemed incredible that people had the courage to stand up against the entire establishment, but the brave British people did it. Oh, and by the way, the last opinion poll says that now 68% of the British people want us to get on with Brexit. And then a funny thing happened. I went to the Republican convention in Cleveland, and I realised that amongst the Republican activists and amongst a large chunk of the American people, there was something approaching Brexit mania. And I got the opportunity, through my friends in Mississippi, through the governor of Mississippi, I got my opportunity, would I stand on a platform with Donald J. Trump, and would I tell that audience that what we'd done in Brexit was what you two could do here in America? And I told that audience, don't listen to the pollsters, don't listen to the media, don't listen to the commentators. They're trying to break your will. They're trying to make you stay at home. Don't listen to any of them. And I said, we got our country back on June 23rd, and you can get yours back too on November the 8th. And you know what? I am pleased and proud that I did that in Mississippi, and that I came to America many times in that campaign to give Donald Trump support. I'm proud to have been part of that campaign. I really am. And what I'm seeing 36 days in to the Trump presidency, I'm seeing something quite remarkable. I'm seeing an elected leader who is trying to put in place the platform on which he was elected. How about that? Because we've had years, haven't we, of people making promises, getting into power, and not even attempting to put into place the things upon which they've been elected. And I believe that Trump, who is determined, and we saw him this morning, didn't we? And wasn't he just superb? No, what Trump is doing by trying to put in place that ticket on which he was elected, he is restoring faith in the democratic process, and good for him. Good for him. 2016 was the year that the nation state democracy made a comeback against the globalists and those who would wish to destroy everything that we have ever been. But of course, Trump, amazing personality that he is, could not have done it on his own. He had some good people behind him. He had people like Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, and many others. But he also had every single one of you, and this event is your celebration. Well done to all of you. Now, great though the night of June 23rd was, great though the night of November the 8th was, my favourite part of 2016 wasn't so much the victories, no. My favourite part of that evening of November the 8th was watching the faces of the CNN presenters. And you know what? They haven't given up, have they? They are in deep denial. They would like to wind the clock back to 2015 to pretend that none of this had ever happened. But just as Brexit becomes more popular by the day, President Trump will become more popular in America by the day. No, they won't give up. And some of their biggest cheerleaders, I'm thinking of Tony Blair in particular. Oh, wow. So he's popular here too, is he? Fine, good. I think of people like Tony Blair, who says that 2016 was just a blip. 2016 was an aberration. 2016 was just an outpouring of anger from very poorly educated, stupid, virtually unwashed people. That's what Blair thinks. But Tony Blair is wrong. He's wrong because what happened in 2016 is not the end of this great global revolution. What happened in 2016 is the beginning of a great global revolution. And this will roll out across the rest of the West. We've got some very exciting elections coming up in the Netherlands, in France, in Germany, possibly even in Italy. And believe me, I don't yet know whether the results in 2017 will be as dramatic as the results in 2016. But what I do know is that even if the challengers don't get over the line in this year, what they will do is shift the centre of gravity of the entire debate. Because what is happening across Europe, is people are rejecting this form of supranational government. They're rejecting the idea of being governed by a bunch of unelected old men in Brussels. Although I'm very grateful to these unelected old men, because I've had some real sport with them in the European Parliament over the last couple of years. And they're rejecting the absolute madness and idiocy of what Angela Merkel did 18 months ago when she opened up her doors. And we've got to be clear, we're not against anybody based on religion or ethnicity. We're not against anybody, but we're for ourselves. We're for our country. We're for our communities. We're for making our people safe and with less risk from global terror. That is what we're for. That is what we're for. And we're for our country. And we're for our people. and we are winning! Thank you.
All right. All right, and we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth on BBS Radio. That was Nigel Farage, a courageous man of our time. Trust me, he's going to turn out to be one of the incredible men of our history. This time, we need a courageous man to do the right things, and sometimes the challenges are enormous, because what we have to do, we have to reveal also the mistakes of the past, and it's not easy. For example, if you think about what England had to go through to get out of the European Union, which was a big mistake for all Europe to unite, because they wanted just to defeat America. That was their purpose. But you know what happens when you are united to defeat somebody, you at the end, they'll defeat you. So just imagine what is going through the European Union as we speak. But we have to look also closer. And since I am in Israel, the Holy Land, we have to look closer to what the Israeli history made and the mistake that we all see. And we have to recover, we need to amend, and we need to make sense of what happened. Let me give you just a little insight to it. Let's listen to it.
After forced flight from Iraq, where they are systematically being expelled, the Iraqi government has frozen Jewish property and bank accounts. To date, 30,000 Jews have been evacuated to Israel, with another 70,000 awaiting the airlift. The refugees are taken to improvised camps. This group goes to Mabara in the Judean hills. Here are Jews from all parts of the world, many of whom are beginning an agricultural life for the first time. To irrigate their frugal vegetable patches properly, water must be piped from miles away. Some, like this shoemaker, continue trades from earlier days, like this plumber and this photographer. They still must build permanent dwellings, must wrest a living out of the harsh soil, and must reestablish the integrated life of Israel carried with them through 20 centuries of wandering.
20 centuries of wandering. So there we go. We have those refugees arriving to Israel, and they come from all different countries. Now, the country was given to some leadership for the Zionist movement, which had a very good understanding to how work things out. And together with the English, they implemented some rule and order. And in that rule of order, they put a lot of refugees that came from Yemen. People that they lost everything and they are, not capable of doing much, but working with their hands and not much of education. And they come to the country with children. After the World War II, there were many family that, from the European descendant that did not have children. And there was some kind of stress, I guess, in Israel. We're talking right now in 1950. Around that time, 1950, the children from Yemen or children from the Arab countries, the Jewish refugee that came there, had something in common. There were more than one child per family, and there were probably many are not well organized like the European one. And what happened is that when they were making babies and when they delivered, some people, which were angels of nobody, took the decision to, liberate those family from some children. And it come to pass that in that time, 1950, many children were dispersed in the hospitals, telling the parents that they died or they fell ill, and then they were taken to a different hospital until they vanished. Now, today I was invited to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to stand together with all those families. You're talking about real family, you know, not stories, people, women that could have been my, you know, the age of my mother, maybe, God bless her soul, or, you know, not even that. And they were standing there looking for answers and asking the government of Israel to open all the archives about the history of those children and their so-called adoptions, because many people think also that they went to be adopted, but it's not an adoption if it's not a willful adoption, right? So we're talking about kidnapping of those children. So right now in Israel, we have a story, a very sad story, that never been told in the scale to get some you know, human rights or any kind of activism. And usually, you know, those Yemeni family are very loving people. They don't they don't much about talking or saying, but that pain was among humongous today, and I felt it, you know, crying with them, because they say that the tears are dried, you know, all those years. But they were standing, member of parliament was standing there. She is a child that both her big brother and a big sister vanished to her parents because they took them away. Then you have another member, vice minister, and he talked about his brother that vanished. And for God's sake, they are in power. What is not clear? They could go after the knowledge and discover those files. So one investigation was made, and the Prime Minister was very concerned and said, we're going to do the best to release the information. And sure enough, he sent another minister. I'm not going to mention his name. And they said, oh, we are releasing all the documents, right? No, it's not right. They didn't. So right now, we don't have names. We don't have, you know, they have tons of people alive looking for the children. And for all those years, we're talking since the 50s, so we're talking about 67 years that those children are missing. And the government of Israel, and I'm not talking, listen, you know me and I love Israel, right? Let's be fair. But the pain of those parents today, knowing that in one archive, that one judge or two judges decided that they cannot release this information, I want those released now. And I'll tell you what's the problem, the biggest problem is. The biggest problem is that we have an American side to the story. And what's the American side? Those children, they did not vanish to Israel. They vanished and were shipped elsewhere, to America, Europe. We don't know, but we definitely know the ship to America. So let's do something very creative here. Let's think about, you know, a mother that arrived with a little child, you know, a newborn child to America, and says, this is my newborn, right? What are you going to tell her? You know, you cannot let her in, you cannot register it. I would like to see some lists from the exit, or from Israel, they won't let, you know, they're trying to be oblivious to the knowledge. But America is something else. In America, we have a really good foundation of truth and liberty. And the information that all those people got inside the country, bringing children that are not there, kidnap children, and raising them, think about them. They must be now around 60 years old, those children. You have children of other families that are living, let's say even one is too many, living in America because they've been kidnapped when they were infant, newborn. They don't know what happened to them. They were raised, and they probably don't look even the same, but DNA must find them. Anyway, truth must be said, and we need to come to conclusion with that. But the first thing that America needs to press to realize that she was a part of it. I know it's startling. I know that it's incredible, but it's the real truth. And today I was a part of this history, witnessing it. And trust me, tears you apart to see that. So I said this, and I was witness to what the situation is, and I'm calling on all good angels in the world to come alike and help us solve those incredible, incredible story. Let's listen to some music, and we'll be back after that.
Divo! Everybody's talking, and no one says a word. Everybody's making love, and no one really cares. There's Natchez in the bathroom, just below the stairs.
And this is Orly Benny Davis with you back. You see, we need to start making courageous decisions so we can go on. And so many times people ask me why their life is stagnant. I always advise, go back to where you made mistake and fix it. Because sometimes you are in the crossroad and you don't know why and you cannot fix it. You cannot go on until you fix it, or you can fix it if you try. It will take some courage, of course, and a humble being. Saying I'm sorry is not easy, but sometimes you'll find it. And you know, Nigel Farage was talking about what the European Union took from them. And he was talking about, free trade, about choosing their own friends. And he said liberty of the borders and democracy and freedom. And I was thinking, hey, it's like being married. You have no right to negotiate anymore. You don't choose your own friend. You have your house is becoming somebody else's house because it's not. And freedom is gone. The same thing, it's a little different, but... But I really related to it. So I love Nigel Farage for that. But let's keep on going. We have some other things that we need to correct while we're correcting, the good and bad. Let's listen to what, Palestinian state looks like.
I prefer not to deal with labels, but with substance. And I ask both former prime ministers to ask a simple question. What kind of state will it be that they're advocating? A state that calls for Israel's destruction? A state that whose territory will be used immediately for radical Islam? Israel retreated already from Gaza, took up all the settlements there, gave the territory to the Palestinian Authority, and this became a terrorist state of Hamas backed by Iran. They fired thousands and thousands of missiles against us. So clearly when people say they're for a Palestinian state, they're not for that kind of state. What kind of state would they be talking about? Well, first of all, it'll have to recognize the Jewish state. It's not conceivable that people will say the Palestinians should have a state and continue to call for the annihilation of the Jewish state, Israel. So, obviously, asking the Palestinians to recognize a Jewish state is mandatory, and people must do that. Secondly, we know that in the realities of the Middle East, if Israel is not there to ensure security, then that state very quickly will become another bastion of radical Islam. So this is what I've been talking about. And I've been talking about it for 8 years. I said we have to make sure that the Palestinians recognize a Jewish state, and we have to ensure that Israel has the overriding security control of all the territories, all the territories. Other than that, I want the Palestinians to be able to govern themselves and to have all the freedoms to do so, but not the freedom to destroy the Jewish state. They have to recognize Israel, and Israel has to have the residual military control. That's my view. It hasn't changed.
Our position is exactly the same as it always has been for many years. We support an outcome which has two states, where the Israeli people, the Palestinian people live side by side as a result of direct negotiations between them, and that is the fundamental point, and live together in peace and the security that they're entitled to expect. And you can't expect, being blunt and realistic about this, you cannot expect any Israeli government to put itself in a position where it is security is at risk, where its citizens are not safe. The first duty of every government is the safety of the people. That's my first job as Prime Minister of Australia. It's Bibi's first job as Prime Minister of Israel. So that's our position, has been the same for many, many years. And the key is direct negotiations between the parties. And I would add, Bibi, if I may, that I agree with you in that the circumstances of the times and in your area, your region, which you clearly have a keener insight into than we do here in Australia, do appear to create the opportunity where perhaps the moons are aligning such that this could be a good time to come back to the table, for the parties to come back to the table and reach an agreement. But, of course, as with any agreement, it needs to tango.
All right. I think we are back, and it's Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Did you hear? We are talking about two-state solution everywhere, and the question was raised to Donald J. Trump, the president of the USA. What do you think? And he said, whatever you choose. And the answer was a little vague. What do you mean by what do you want? And the truth is, what they actually mean when they say two-state solution. And I would tell you that there is no such a thing, two-state solution, because they want, Gaza is one area, it's Palestinian, of course, Israel evacuated. Then you have Jordan, that 80% of the population there is Palestinian. And then they want something in between Judea and Samaria that will be another hole of terrorists. So they're actually looking at three ways versus Israel, the fourth way. I don't know why everybody in the world keep on talking about it. Think about Angela Merkel that almost lost to Martin Schulz, and I give it to Martin Schulz that he had a good fight, but he wasn't actually ready. He came late in the game, and he was playing, playing a good game. So when Angela Merkel just got a little aggravated, she threw back, we want a two-state solution. And I'm telling you guys, there is no such a thing as two-state solution, because the two-state solution already exists, Jordan and Israel. The rest, Gaza, is already the third state that you're talking about. I'm not sure how to give it to the rest of the world, but this nonsense has to stop. And I'm calling it nonsense because this is the mantra of the Clintons. The Clinton administration in 1994 decided that they're going to force Israel and the Palestinians to make peace. They brought even Yasser Arafat, the arch terrorist, to the White House, and he had a gun. He had a gun, and he wanted to show out to the ceremony with a gun. And President Clinton decided that he's not going to let him, and he was right, of course. But think about it. You had Mr. Rabin that didn't want to shake his hands, forced to shake his hands. And sure enough, the year later, he was dead. He was killed. Everybody was saying, oh, it was a radical, extreme right wing. And if you look at him, there was nothing extreme about him, and it was nothing like a right wing. And the story behind that assassination was incredible, because they were talking about conspiracy, and he was told that they were blank in those that gun. And many that investigate that murder say that there were like three shots. And not one. It's you know, it's like the saga that we all know, that when somebody important is getting killed, you have all kind of version of the stories. And one version nobody ever suggested, that the conspiracy was due to the peace accord, because they wanted him out of the way. He didn't want to give up Jerusalem, and of course it was easier to get rid of him. And sure enough, you know, Paris followed suit after that. I don't know what to say, but I'm just saying that whatever you see sometimes in politics, it's not what they give you. It's not what is real. And when you're told the story, be careful to believe. And when you have history like, you know, the recent history of the press, you can bet that the story that they tell you are not right. Think about what happens right now with the press dinner in the White House, that decided to make it even with the president, Donald Trump, that is not going to show up. It's like the audacity of those people. But I'm saying he doesn't want to go, because if it's not a friendly dinner, why should he attend? And sure enough, it's really sad for the press to arrive to such a standoff with the president. And I'm saying that not because I like Donald Trump, because I like him. It's because they lost their perspective of what's real. The media is the watchdog of democracy. Right now, we need somebody to watch out over them, because they lost it, as our dear Congressman Joe Wilson from South Carolina said the other day. He was quoting Senator Lindsey Graham. He said, they lost the election and now they're losing their mind. So we want the media to be back to those days that we can count on them, and to stop running after the president. And in Israel, we want him to stop running after the prime minister, because it's the audacity of them running and, you know, and asking all sort of questions. I don't know what to do with that. It's a part of everyday material, but I'm saddened. I'm saddened that they lost the attraction of saying and talking about real issues, the philosophy of democracy, and what a country needs to look like, what a courageous leader needs to be doing, you know, what we supposed to look for. Give us some guidance if you are a good, you know, watchdog to democracy, if you are knowledgeable. But it becomes so pathetic. They're screaming for, you know, for impeachment. You guys understand what impeachment? You know that Bill Clinton could have been impeached for one thing only. Forget the fact that he and whatever Lewinsky was doing, but the fact that he ruined the fabric of society. That's one of the material that, you know, can be a subject of impeachment. To ruin the fabric of society means when you ruin them. And if you remember, before Clinton administration, everything was covered up like very good and dandy. there wasn't all those shenanigans that came after. They lost some of their prudes, I can say. And that's it. He definitely ruined he ruins a lot of things. And one thing that I'm so sorry, because I followed him incredibly. I was so inspired by him. I wanted him to be there forever. But after, when I look at the history book and see what happens, said, you know, maybe it wasn't such a good presidency after all. All right, guys, let's get some music and we'll be back after that. All right, so we are back, and I'm telling you, it's really a challenging time for all of us, because we are trying to direct our roots again, and some of the troops decide to act up, and the Democratic Party in America looks from far away like a 2-year-old tantrum babies, you know, 2 years old when they give a tantrum. That's what the Democratic Party looks like, especially when they have a new daddy, a new chairman, which I hope is going to be good. It sounds really, really nice. I hope that they can collect them and put them back to act and work together with everybody, because we are sick and tired of those days. Now is, think about it, it's February 27th, 2017. It's since November 8th that we are having a tantrum, America. America, we are tired to see you all gushing and hushing about Donald Trump. We need some quiet. And your show in Hollywood gave you what you really, really need, some action inside. And you know, God has a very way, a good way of, you know, interacting with some people. You make a mess inside their own home, so they stop bugging the others. Remember Hollywood? Remember how you went out of your way to slam Donald Trump? Can't even get one freaking envelope right. So, hee-ha for you guys, and, you know, hasta la vista, because we are all done with you. Anyway, let's go back. We have some Ben Stein video or recording. Let's listen to it.
Trump announcing via Twitter that he is skipping the time-honored White House Correspondents' Dinner, an event that started all the way back in 1920. President Trump tweeting earlier, "I will not be attending the White House Correspondents' Association dinner this year. Please wish everyone well and have a great evening." Mr. Trump will be the first president to miss the dinner in more than 35 years. The last was President Reagan, who skipped in 1981 while he was recovering after being shot. Reagan still called in by phone, however, and I want to talk about what this means for an already contentious relationship between the press and the White House. With me now is economist Ben Stein. He served as a speechwriter and a lawyer for President Richard Nixon. He also worked on the other side as a journalist. Ben, I suppose you are not particularly surprised by this development.
I'm not surprised at it. I'm not disappointed at it. And I don't blame Mr. Trump one bit for doing it. I mean, he's a punching bag day after day after day in the media, especially what's called the mainstream media, and I don't blame him for not wanting to go and be a punching bag in person.
Okay, so did you hear what he said yesterday at CPAC, where he's talking about the media?
I saw some of it actually on CNN as you were excerpting it. Yes, I had that pleasure.
So he said that he called the media the enemy of the people, which is what we heard him say before on Twitter. So he said that out loud. He accused the media of making things up, of making up sources. Is that something you would give credence to, or what is going on there with what he's saying?
Well, I wouldn't say that all of the media is the enemy of the people, but look, every day you pick up the New York Times, every day they're slamming him. I'm a great fan of CNN. I watch it quite faithfully. Every day CNN is slamming him. Every day they're looking for a scandal. They're just turning the woods upside down looking for a scandal. They're hoping, I think, to do to him what they did to Nixon a long time ago. And I still haven't found any real scandals. And I, with all due respect, I don't blame him for being furious at them. And I think he's got a lot of company. I'm out there giving speeches all around the country all the time. People, awful lot of people are not great fans of the media, and they see the media as an unelected aristocracy and a effete corps of impudent snobs, as Vice President Agnew called them a long time ago, who are dumping all over the mainstream of America. And I think Mr. Trump has a lot of company.
Do you think some of what goes on is self-inflicted by Mr. Trump?
Mr. Trump is not the smoothest operator. I mean, he's not Bob Hope. He's thin-skinned, and he fires right back. I agree. There's no doubt some of it is self-inflicted. But I think this general idea that the press can just hack away at the president, that he is expected to just sit there and take it, is not a sound idea. And I've noticed day after day, week after week, everything's negative. Not one positive response. I mean, here's a guy who picked a person generally among the legal profession, and I am a lawyer as well known, awful lot of lawyers, very well respected guy as the Supreme Court Justice, we hope, and hardly any positive coverage of that. He is doing what his constituents asked him to do.
May I counter that, Ben?
Because please, of course, that's
when,
why you're
when
there.
When Gorsuch went up and spoke to a Democratic senator, we covered in depth the fact that Gorsuch had said something that actually endeared him to Democrats, and that actually a lot of establishment Republicans appreciated, and it actually many people thought tempered Gorsuch, or at least revealed him as they felt to be a moderate that they think he is. I mean, how are we covering this in a negative way, maybe a nuanced way? Or Donald Trump goes to the African American History Museum and he talks about countering bigotry, and we cover that as well.
Yes, you did cover that. So that's one of hundreds of stories, most of which are extremely negative. And God bless you for doing that positive stuff. But look at the way they slammed him for not covering right immediately the desecration of the Jewish cemetery outside St. Louis. I mean, this is a guy, and look at the way the media is endlessly playing him up as an anti-Semite. This is a guy who has a Jewish son-in-law, whose own daughter converted to Judaism, who's never been quoted saying a single anti-Semitic word, and they're constantly slamming him as being a racist or a white supremacist or something without any evidence of it at all. I think, with the greatest respect, and I appreciate your pointing out things where I was mistaken, but with the greatest respect, this is a guy that they're just smearing all the time. I don't blame him for wanting to fire back at them. If he were as smooth as Ronald Reagan, he would handle it more smoothly. But no one, again, will ever be as smooth as Ronald Reagan.
You said you think the press is trying to do to him what they did to Richard Nixon.
Yes.
So give us your perspective on that, because a lot of people look at what happened to Richard Nixon and they say, I mean, what Richard Nixon did to himself. The tapes from the Oval Office showed that 6 days after the Watergate break-in, he was discussing himself. He was discussing a cover-up, you know, the smoking gun tape. How did the media do that to Richard Nixon?
The media picked one tiny little thing that he did. One tiny little thing he did, which is just to discuss a cover-up. He didn't do the cover-up. They didn't follow through with the cover-up payments that he discussed. They just discussed it. This was a guy who brought more peace to the world than any president in the 20th century. Open relations with China. First strategic arms limitation talks with the Soviet Union and leading to an agreement. Ended the war in Vietnam. Brought home the prisoners of war. Saved the life of the state of Israel. And so
you think the Watergate scandal and what was uncovered was phooey?
it was not a good thing. Shouldn't have done it, obviously. But compared with his achievements, nothing. And I think they're doing the exact same thing to Mr. Trump, whose achievements, by the way, compared with Nixon, are nil. But I think they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to undo him basically before he even gets started. I mean, I think it's just extremely unfortunate. The country has real problems, and for them to be focusing on trying to bring down this guy before he's even gotten started is a serious mistake. We have real problems.
All right, Ben Stein, thank you so much, sir. We certainly appreciate you joining us.
All right, and we're back. You know, it's true. They all try to undo President Trump from the beginning, and it's the same thing that they did to George W. Bush. If you remember correctly, they did not stop until it was 2000, until 9/11 came about, and then we had to go to war. But this shakeup that the Democrats choose to do every time they don't get their way, it's appalling. I don't know how to call it. And it's the same thing that we in Israel have at the Labor Party, that they shake up and shake them up so bad until something will happen. But sure enough, tomorrow they're going to have another report of the war that took place in 2014. And something you have on this Impossible Truth archive is they, a week by week, recounted to what happened. So if you remember, the war of 2000, July 2014 in Israel, started by the Phoenician at the end of June, because that's when they kidnapped those children. Or the youth, they killed them. They took three lives, and they started the war. And on that time, I started my very first show. It was on 7/7/2014 that I started the show. And you can hear on the first show we had a live siren, and when it was the first actually siren ever heard for that war, so. After that, a week after, we talk about it, and I'm sure that if you go time by time, you will have a vivid recount of what that war was about. So if they are investigating this, by all means, we need to check whatever we can to make sure that nobody goes to war for nothing. But there was no nothing, because they started the war as usual. And I remember mailing and writing to everybody, saying, you know, they need to calm down, because Israel cannot hold their troops for too long. We were asking them to back off, but they were sending those missiles and they were sending those rockets, and they didn't stop. And I know that we have all terrorist camps all around, that they become itchy. But I hope that we can turn the page on history and start talking about how we can do to heal the area, because it's time of healing. It's time to come together. And if, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans will come together and show us what unity looks like, we can have a good example. If we can talk about, the Labor Party here and the Likud Party, if they join forces to overcome the challenges of the future, you never know, because at a new day, we need to be strong, and together we're strong. I hope you understand that life is too short to fight all the time, and we have to reinvent the world again, but this time in a good way. Let's give it a shot. Let's give it a try. Why not? We have it. We have all what it takes. We can make it. All right? So by all means, I'm sending you all my love. I remind you all that there is a God, and it's not us. So we all have to behave and get along with each other, because this is one world we all have to share. And to all of you in the Middle East, I hope that you have a blessed evening. And I hope that you come to terms with the reality that the world is beautiful and we must shape up. So have a good starting of a new month for the Jewish people, because it's a party time. And for the rest of you, I hope you enjoy your Oscar. God bless you. Ciao, ciao.